We're going to go on to 13-3012, and that's United States of America versus Majewski. Coming up, Mr. Levine. Be a minute. Okay, let me just get myself together. All right. Hi, Mr. Levine.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Levine.
What?
It's Levine. If it pleases the court.
Mr. Levine, you tried your first case in front of me.
And my second, Judge.
How many years
Five,
ago?
Five,
25 years ago. You've aged well. Go ahead.
Thank you, Judge. It's all internal.
What about her?
She looks marvelous.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that's obvious. I don't have to state the obvious.
Okay. You'll have your turn.
Thank you, Jeff. My name is Jeff Levine, if it pleases the court. Andrew Majewski pled guilty to trading photos through a peer-to-peer networks. He was a young kid. When I first met him, I thought he was 14 years old. As a kid, he stuttered and lisped, and he was very thin and young-looking. He was a victim. He was a victim as a child. He was sexually abused by a neighbor. He was sexually assaulted as a teenager, and awaiting sentencing, he was assaulted at the MCC. He's presently in solitary confinement based on death threats. He pled guilty to the charges, and the defense spent its energy on Mr. Majewski getting therapy and presenting sentencing positions. We hired and presented an expert witness, Dr. Lisa Roan, a psychiatrist. Dr. Roan teaches psychiatry at Northwestern University in Chicago. At sentencing, Mr. Majewski presented the testimony of Dr. Roan. After the direct examination, the court came in, and now the government did not present any expert testimony at sentencing. Dr. Roan presented her opinion that Mr. Majewski was not a pedophile and that he had empathy for others, specifically the victims. The court had an alternative belief. The court believed that, let's see what the court did. The court first initiated a cross-examination subsequent to the government's cross-examination.
And are you contending that any of those rulings that were made, because it was a very odd situation, you were objecting to the court's questions, she overruled those questions, that any of those rulings are incorrect?
My concern, and obviously I was objecting because I had specific concerns about what the court was doing, but I was obviously dealing with an expert opinion, a specific opinion that I could not cross-examine. And I was trying to alert the court to what was happening with those objections. Why I thought I gave the reasons for the objections at the time I objected. But it put me in a position of having to object to the court's inquiry.
And is the bottom line on your objection that the court then assumed a rather prosecutorial role, and also the basis for some of those questions and the manner in which it was done was as if the court was an expert? Is that part of what is going on here?
The court seemed to have an opinion as to whether or not my expert's opinion was correct or not. And the court has...
Well, that's what a judge does, right? Doesn't it? A judge is not bound by the expert's opinion. The judge evaluates the reliability of the opinion and whether it fits the particular case.
Well, the judge is there to make decisions and with regard to the introduction and acceptance of evidence. Okay? And she was making an opinion, and she must do that based on the evidence presented. In this case, we contend that what the court did in a very emotional situation, the court overruled the evidence of the expert opinion and inserted her own lay opinion in place of the expert.
Did you object to the use of information from the court's treatise? I noticed that you specifically said in the reply brief that you were aware of the court's treatise and even cited it in
briefing
on sentencing.
I did not believe, going into the sentencing, that the court would present its own opinion contrary to the testimony of our expert.
So you're saying that a judge is bound by the expert's opinion as long as there is not a contrary expert opinion on the other side?
That's not what I'm saying. No. I'm saying in this case, in this specific instance, when the defense presented an expert opinion, and the opinion was that of a learned expert who was qualified as an expert, the court could not have imposed its own opinion as a lay individual and over the expert opinion of the witness.
That seems like a roundabout way of saying that the court is bound by the opinion if there's not a contrary opinion. And in this instance,
I think the court has to. I'm sorry.
In this instance, the judge didn't conclude that your client was a pedophile, but concluded that there was a pedophilic identification in the court's opinion, which is a different way of looking at this than I think your expert.
Right now, yes, but the court did not examine the individual.
Forgive me, Mr. Levine. You better stay in front of that mic or we won't
be able to
listen to you again and again and again and again.
It's a habit I have.
We may want to.
Unlike Dr. Roan did a medical examination of the individual, of Mr. Majewski. The court did not do a medical examination of Mr. Majewski, and therefore her conclusions were not based on information gained from medical experience, from diagnosis, from going through everything with the defendant. In fact, Mr. Majewski never spoke until he had a brief colloquy prior to sentencing. So for the court to make a diagnosis here, she was making very specific diagnosis that he had no empathy for others, and that I believe it was a pedophiliac identification.
That is a medical term, pedophilic identification, correct?
I believe it is.
And so what we're trying to get at is the difference between the court, say, rejecting testimony and saying, I don't find the Dr. Roan credible, Dr. Roan didn't take into account certain things, Dr. Roan never examined the pornography, Dr. Roan has holes in it, therefore I don't find Dr. Roan credible. And I believe that he would engage in inappropriate behavior, or I'm not convinced that he would not continue to do this if he didn't get a long sentence. It wasn't sort of that general sort of opining, I mean, disregarding the testimony. It was, is your objection that this specific diagnosis was made by the court? Had there been any testimony of a pedophilic identification by the expert where the expert defined that term?
The expert, I believe, specifically testified that he did not, and I believe I had two there was a report, prior report, and then Dr. Roan reviewed that prior report and then made a determination based on her examination of Mr. Majewski that he was specifically not and that had the empathy.
So, but the difference between this pedophilic identification versus being a pedophile, is there anything in the medical DSM, or I'm not familiar with that. I know the term is there. I'm trying to determine whether that was a different type of diagnosis.
And I believe Dr. Roan made the diagnosis based on her experience. I don't know exactly if it's a medical diagnosis. I assume it is. The determination she made, I believe, was a medical. I knew I had to hire a psychiatrist to present this opinion. as this court suggests at sentencing of these types of cases. I did, with regard to the second issue, I did quite a bit of work with regard to the pleadings, with regard to all types of arguments on a sentencing basis, one with the guidelines, purposes being uniformity of sentence, and I demonstrated, I argued that there was not uniformity in sentence with these, and maybe 15 different pleadings with regard to the sentencing.
I'm going to give you a little more time. I know you're way into your rebuttal, but I mean,
I'll give you more time.
I want to ask you this. It's unclear whether you're making your recusal argument under subsection A or subsection B of 29455. Which is it?
I believe I made it under both, as I recall.
Okay.
I'll step aside.
Okay, thank you. And we're going to have Ms. Simdahl come up, please.
May it please the court. My name is Stephanie Simdahl, and I represent the United States. In this case, the district judge did not err by failing to recuse herself in this case. To begin with, the defendant has actually waived his claims that the district court judge should have recused herself.
No, he hasn't. By the time the court asked whether the defendant had any further issues that needed to be addressed, the court had already pronounced sentence. Is he supposed to then say to the court, reconsider the sentence already pronounced? I'd appreciate it if you'd go on to your next argument.
In terms of the 455.
Did I understand you to be saying that he waived the argument that she should have recused under 455A?
Yes, Your Honor. One of the prongs is 455A, which has the issue of the appearance of impropriety. And this court has been clear that defendants must seek a writ of mandamus and most certainly raise the issue to the district court if they are moving under that prong of 455.
Mr. Line was aware that Judge Kendall had authored that treatise and so forth prior to
Honor. Prior to the proceeding, he admits all of this in his reply brief. And you can also see all of this in his filings, prior to the sentencing hearing, that he was aware of Judge Kendall's knowledge of the greater subject matter of child exploitation and, in fact, cited to her treatise himself in his own filings.
Do you have a different argument as to 455B?
Your Honor, we would actually ask this court to adopt a rule of waiver under Rule 455B in situations in which parties are fully aware of the facts, such as in this case, the judge's knowledge of the area of child exploitation and her information that she has written a treatise and, in fact, had published sources. We would ask this court to adopt a rule of waiver in situations where defendants are fully aware of all the facts and could have moved for recusal below, but instead they choose to sit on a claim. Many other circuits have found that this is indeed the case under Rule 455B as well as Rule 455A, because otherwise it allows defendants to play strategic games and wait to see if they are happy with the sentence they receive before they raise the issue of disqualification.
You know, the judge's examination of Dr. Roan reads like an aggressive cross-examination by the government. The court appears to have relied on information outside the record, including her own treatise, in discrediting some of the expert's testimony. What I kept wondering, reading through the transcript of all of that, was what was Mr. Levine supposed to do in this case? He couldn't very well say to the judge, "Judge, you take the stand so that I can test the hypotheses of your treatise." What was he supposed to do?
Your Honor, I believe he did have an opportunity to redirect his own expert witness, which did allow him an opportunity to clarify any issues that perhaps he thought were unclear during the district court's cross-examination or examination of the expert.
I don't know how long you've been an assistant U.S. attorney, but have you ever heard of anything quite like this?
to be honest, Your Honor, this is my first experience with this happening during a sentencing hearing. However, I've certainly been involved in cases in which judges step in during trial or other instances to question witnesses and to clarify issues. I think much of what was happening here was the district court judge was seeking to follow up on questions that were asked by the government during its cross-examination to further clarify exactly what the expert had considered. A close review of the transcript shows that the district court judge on the one hand and the expert actually agreed about the important information of what the DSM-5 required as criteria for a diagnosis of pedophilia. They were in agreement about what the criteria was. The issue was whether or not the expert witness had actually considered certain key factual information in this case in reaching her conclusion under those criteria.
Is determining whether a person is a pedophile a matter for expert testimony? Because if it is, on what grounds could the court discredit the expert with her own lay view of the subject? I mean, it seems, reading through all of that, it certainly seemed as if the court was substituting its own opinion for that of the expert.
Your Honor, I believe what the district court judge was doing here was not substituting her own opinion based on any outside knowledge, but simply asking the expert on many of these issues, upon which they did agree about the criteria, did you consider this? Did you look at the images? No. Do you agree that that's important under the criteria, that you should have looked at the images? Yes, but I didn't need to here. Did you consider the time period during which the defendant was doing all this? No. Is that one of the criteria? Yes. The judge here was doing what judges always do, which is questioning the expert, critically evaluating whether or not the expert's testimony actually made sense, whether it considered all of the relevant evidence, and thus whether or not it was a reliable opinion upon which the court could rely.
Well, a few minutes ago you said you'd never seen anything like this. I can tell you I haven't.
I've certainly seen things where judges ask questions. I have not been involved in a case before, Your Honor, to be honest, in which the judge questioned an expert in a particular area in which the judge also had a background. To be honest to the court, I have not. I think it's important as well in this case that the defendant has not shown that the district court judge's rejection of the expert's opinion on that one point, and only on that one point, made a difference to affecting his sentence.
How could he do that? How would he do that?
How would he show that it affected the sentence?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's important here that he could show that if there were ways in which this increased the defendant's sentence or changed the way that the judge actually impacted the sentence.
How?
It would be visible in the transcript. For example, in this case, the judge said that the term pedophilia was not even necessary for her findings, and she made clear repeatedly that she made no finding and that there was no evidence that the defendant had been a contact offender or would have been a contact offender. So in many ways, this...
So that's why I was having trouble with this pedophilic identification, trying to make the distinction, because it seems like she made some distinction.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor. My understanding, and I apologize to the court if I'm wrong, is that pedophilic identification is not an independent term under the DSM-5 or any other diagnostic manual. My understanding, my belief as to what the judge was saying is that I believe he's more likely to be a pedophile, but it doesn't matter because they don't need to define that
and
term.
And the expert concluded that he wasn't a pedophile, correct?
Correct.
Judge Kendall did not conclude that he was a pedophile either, correct?
She did not. She stated that a pedophilic identification was more likely, but that the term pedophile was not necessary for her findings, and she made no finding that he would become a contact offender. And in fact, she used that view that there was no evidence that he would become a contact offender as a key mitigation point when she later gave him a significantly below guideline sentence. Your Honor, I would just briefly move on to 455.
Remind me of how significant. I have the case before this one in both in my head on the sentence.
Yes, Your Honor. The guideline range was 210 to 262 months, and he received a sentence of 180 months. So 30 months below the low end of the guideline range.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the appearance of bias here, The district court judge, while disagreeing with the defense expert on one point, also credited her and information contained within her reports, including the defendant's prior history of abuse, when she was looking at the mitigation factors and when she was fashioning a sentence. She credited many of the mitigation factors quite heavily in this case. She found that the defendant had youth, had not engaged in contact offenses, no criminal history. She also focused significantly on his own prior victimization and the fact that he cooperated with authorities in this case to some extent as mitigation factors that led to a significantly below guideline sentence.
What sentence did the government request?
The government recommended a sentence that was modestly below the low end of the guideline range.
But more than 180 months?
The government didn't put a specific number to it in terms of exactly how far would be appropriate.
So, I mean, the word modestly was used as...
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
That was the request of the government in all of its filings and during the sentencing hearing.
If you want to take three more minutes, you may, because I am going to give Mr. Levine three more minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm happy to continue to address the 455 recusal issue if the court has any more questions, or I can move on to briefly address the court's handling of the defendant's sentencing arguments. It is the government's position that the defendant has waived any issue and any claim that the district court judge did not properly consider certain of his principal mitigation arguments. Just as this court directed in United States v. Garcia-Garcura, at the end of the sentencing hearing, the defendant was asked, are there any issues that you feel the court has not fully addressed? I'd be happy to do so at this time. And the defendant did not raise any arguments, including the two that he raises here.
But the sentence had already been, that's what I said before, the sentence had already been pronounced.
Yes, Your Honor, it had, and I believe
that. So what does he say, you've pronounced the sentence, Judge, but... Would you reconsider that? I mean, I don't understand your argument at all.
Under the guidance of this court in the Garcia-Segura case, that is, in fact, the appropriate time to do so. I think in some ways it becomes hard for a defendant to object before a judge has pronounced sentence because you don't know what else the judge is going to say. The defendant cannot know if the judge has fully addressed his primary mitigation arguments until the point that the judge reaches the end of its colloquy in sentencing. And as this court directed in that prior case and recently recognized in U.S. v. Dinelli, the government did follow that process and the court followed that procedure here. And by not raising those issues, the government would suggest to this court that he has waived those arguments.
Yes. I just had a question. In terms of the sentencing, when the court is reviewing some of his behavior, she ultimately says, and therefore, with that in mind, the pedophilic identification in this court's opinion is much more accurate. So that's a little different than the earlier statement where she says she didn't need to resolve anything, right?
She does.
This is at the time of the sentencing, so... That sounds a little more definitive.
She doesn't, but I believe in just the...
That's at page 130, line
yes, Your Honor.
5-6.
I believe if you view that in light of her prior statement, however, that she doesn't need to define pedophile, that this can simply be seen as her explanation as to why she is not crediting the expert on that one particular point. And she also makes clear as well throughout the sentencing hearing, both earlier in the case and during her pronouncement of the sentence, that she does not find the defendant to have committed or be likely to commit contact offenses in the future, which is certainly a key point to both sentencing and to any sort of decision on whether or not the defendant was or was not a pedophile, which really was not a necessary determination to sentence him on a child pornography case. Thank you. If the court has no further questions, we would ask that the court affirm the defendant's sentence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Come on up, Mr. Levine.
Thank you.
I do want to ask you this. We all know that the court sentenced Mr. Majewski to a below the guideline sentence. Does he understand that if we vacate and remand, he can do worse on remand?
Sadly, yes.
He understands that.
Sadly, yes.
Sadly, yes.
Sadly, yes.
There's no guarantee he'll do better?
There is no guarantee, and he could do worse. I understand completely, as does my client. I would point out two things just in response to the government. One, I'm very rarely happy with a sentence.
Do you want to say it?
Very rarely happy with a sentence my client's received. I don't wait until, if I'm happy with a sentence, then this occurred. I had no opportunity to raise anything at the time. It was during sentencing. The other thing that you've mentioned here today is that the pedophilia, there's also the instance of whether or not Mr. Majewski had empathy for others. Mr. Majewski did have empathy for his victims. He understood in contacting and reading letters from victims how it affected them and how it affected himself. He discussed with Dr. Rohn that he had empathy for the victims and never realized he was causing them further anguish.
But this chat that he was having sounds like he's coaching the person on the other end of the
Dr.
chat.
Dr. Rohn addressed that as well. She said by the time differentiations, these are like half-second differentiation chats, and we've never admitted that was him. There were other people in the house, and it wasn't part of the offense, so I don't think we have to admit that. But Dr. Rohn said by the time periods in between, this is role-playing. And this is very common with post-traumatic stress disorder. People do role-playing to address what's wrong with them, how they're dealing with the fact that they've been victimized prior. Thank you, Jim.
If there's anything more, you have some...
I've laid everything out as best I could in my pleadings, Jim.
So in terms of the waiver, you might address that part A on the appearance of impropriety. So you didn't file a motion initially, and you were aware of all of this information.
When I reviewed it, I was aware that the court had written a treatise, a lay treatise. In my experience, ex-assistant U.S. attorneys make very good jurists, and I did not believe I had a cause or a basis to bring the matter up and seek different a different court. We had Judge Hibbler. We started out with Judge Hibbler, unfortunately. Then we were transferred to Judge Pallmeyer for a brief time. And I didn't think I had a... I still don't believe I had a basis to seek a transfer.
You were appointed, too.
I was, Judge. It was my honor to be appointed in this case.
Well, it's our privilege to have you.
Thank you, Judge.
So well represent your client, and thank you. And thank you, too. It's our privilege to have you and your friend always, Mr. Findy. So nice to see you. Okay. Thank you, everyone. Case will be taken under advisement. Oh, my. Oh, my.